Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I'm the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And a reminder to those that are with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll see a place to join the chat room in with the usual suspects. And in the course of the show, if you have some observations you'd like to share, or if there are some questions that you would like for us to direct to our guest that we wouldn't doesn't look like we're heading that direction, please put it in there. We'll both be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we're glad to steal those brilliant ideas that roll into it. And it's also a place where if you find halfway through the show you got to run off and take care of some business, once the show is complete, you'll be able to get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, along with any of the after-show discussions we may have. Because if you're with us live at the 60-minute mark, the audio will end, but tape keeps going in case our guests have a point they want to finish making, or we have one more question that we want to roll their way before we let them go for the day. Enough of that, though. Let's go ahead and get on with this week's show. And this week we're going to visit an AOR that especially recently, whether you've been looking at North Africa or you've been looking at Eastern Europe for a change, or if you're focused like a lot of us are on the end game in Afghanistan, there's one particular area that may have dropped from a lot of people's scan, but in what I still prefer to call the Long War in its various iterations, there's one area that's been there from the start and is still critically important to what we're all doing here. And we're talking about the Horn of Africa. You look at the countries in the area, Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, the waters off the coast of Somalia, of course, a lot of people who've been following the issues with piracy are very familiar with that. But since the very beginning, and we'll kind of open it from the with the question that we'll start off with, but from the very beginning, this has been a part that in the background has been ongoing and has some broader context important that I'm sure we'll touch on in the course of the show. And we have simply a superb guest today to help us all better understand what we're looking at. Our guest for the full hour is going to be Rear Admiral Alexander Krongard, USN. He is a deputy commander for Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa there in Djibouti. In this position, he supports the commander of JTF HOA to counter not just the violent extremism that we've seen for quite a while in East Africa, but playing the long game here, fostering regional security cooperation, strengthening our partnership with nations in the area, and to build and maintain the U.S. strategic access to the region. He is also responsible for developing relations with senior military leaders in Africa partner nations and also directing CJTF staff and subordinate commanders supporting the deployed personnel and all the units across the Horn of Africa, AOR. He's a Navy SEAL by training, and Rear Admiral Krongard is also a graduate of Princeton University and also the National War Column. Admiral Krongard, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Perfect. And again, really appreciate you taking time today to visit with us. And I thought to start the show off just as a general scene setter. Most of the listeners of Midrats are very familiar in the almost 13 years, the operations that have been happening over in that eastern part of Africa, in the Horn of Africa, from right after 9/11, where the reconnaissance flights and missions were done, trying to capture some of those Al-Qaeda people trying to escape from the AFPAC theater. Of course, piracy bubbled up in the latter part of last decade. But Somalia has been an issue for quite a while, the conflict with Eritrea. And more importantly, and I think we saw that with the bringing on board of AFRICOM a few years back, is we've grown to appreciate the important partnership aspects of that, which, as we mentioned in your intro, as the deputy commander out there, you're helping JTF HOA further take that mission where it needs to go. But a lot of people may have lost sync in the course of the last 13 years on what the latest iteration of what we're doing out there at JTF HOA. So I thought, you know, what are you would like top of mind for really two different audiences, I think. You have the general public who just may be interested on what the American military is doing and why are we there in the northeast corner of Africa, but also someone whose profession is in the national security arena, either a civilian or somebody in uniform. What are those things you would want to have top of their mind about what the sailors and other service members and other nations that y'all are trying to do there at JTF HOA?
Okay. I would start by just making one point right off the bat is if you went and pulled a command brief explaining what CJTF HOA was doing, 2006 time frame, on the surface it doesn't look like things have changed a lot, and in some senses they haven't, but in other senses they've changed tremendously, and it's a whole new ball game out here, and a lot of that has to do with what's happened in Somalia, the success of the African Union mission in Somalia with the various troop contributing countries and what they've been able to do in Somalia in terms of bringing some degree of peace and stability, or, you know, on the road, I guess, to peace and stability in Somalia. And then the other piece of it is as the other theaters of war, Iraq is drawn down, but Afghanistan draws down, it's turning more military attention here, and you're getting different people here who were here over the last 13 years. And you know, in the end, people are the organization, and not only is all that experience from Afghanistan and Iraq being transferred down here, but you know, it's getting slightly better resourced. The two main pieces of the for your bifurcated audience, I guess it is. You know, first off, why is the U.S. military in Djibouti? And, you know, to begin with, it's the only permanent U.S. military presence on the entire continent of Africa. And if you look at a map of this region, you see that we have an airfield that sits next to a port on an incredibly important a waterway. We've got the Bab el-Mandab Straits not too far from us coming out down the Red Sea and up to the Suez Canal, and a lot of incredibly important commerce goes through this area, either up into the Arabian Gulf or into the Indian Ocean, or going the other way, obviously, up into the Mediterranean. It's interesting when our partners brief, as they do once a week, both the Japanese and Koreans brief, and I'll never forget the Japanese, one of their officers had a page from a Japanese school book that had the various trade routes leading all the way back to Japan, and then based on the thickness of the lines, you could tell how important that particular route was to the well-being of Japan, and there was a big old thick red line going right by Djibouti, and I think the only place, to be honest, that had thicker lines was over by Singapore. So just from a, I guess you would call it old-school strategic geography point of view, this is an incredibly important place. And then there are various road networks and that go from here down into northeastern Africa to places like Ethiopia, which I don't know that a lot of people realize has extraordinary growth right now, and there's a lot happening economically there. So Africa has been changing, and this is a good entree point into Africa, and our presence here does serve to bring some measure of stability. The other big piece is that we have invested enormously in creating these partnerships with the regional militaries. And my boss, Major General Wayne Grigsby, is an extraordinary partnership builder. I have almost three decades in SOF and our Special Operations. Sorry, I'll try to minimize the acronyms. I have virtually three decades, just shy of it, and I have never seen anyone who can create a relationship with foreign military leaders like General Grigsby can. I mean, he's absolutely extraordinary, and he has done an incredible job such that if we need to work something out with a regional military, you know, he's able to get on the phone and or email or even in some cases do a VTC with various senior military officials in particularly the troop contributing countries of Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, or Rwanda, and work with them to either see what they need to do their jobs better or give us information that would help us press their case better and be better advocates for them. And this whole notion of team building and advocacy and then working with the interagency, particularly with USAID, State Department, in some cases the various UN entities and the even the European Union, who actually have quite a bit of they have quite a bit down in the, on the ground in this region, kind of what we call build the gym team, another an acronym I'd never heard of before I came here, but joint interagency, intergovernmental, multinational team. I have to admit, when the first time it came out of General Grigsby's mouth, I laughed, but I'm a believer now, and this gym team in the region of northeastern Africa has been an extraordinary thing to behold.
Well, Admiral, when you talk about the CJTF, can you kind of roll us through what the food chain is for that? I mean, it's a combined joint task force. Who are the components of that, and what the food chain does that answer up to?
It's not much. We work directly for U.S. Africa Command up in Stuttgart. General Grigsby answers directly to General Rodriguez up there. As far as what's beneath us, it's not a lot. When you get done doing our security, you know, securing our bases in the one big base and, you know, a couple of small outposts, if you will. Once you secure those, once you provide certain personnel recovery standby alerts and provide security, say, for ships coming into port, there's not a lot left to project. And that's why if you were to look at our mission statement, we're really about enabling. We have about under 300 people, I think, now on the staff. We're actually taking a pretty heavy decrement in our numbers, and it's 51% reservists. The majority of the reservists are U.S. Navy. At one point in time, and there was only one active duty naval officer on the entire staff. It was me. Now there are two, and I'm still one of them. And we have active duty Marines for the most part, active duty Air Force, and then kind of a mix with the Army. But it's 51% reservists, and it makes things very interesting. We've been able to really tease out some interesting capabilities from the reservists, particularly when you look at the totality of what they bring to the fight, both on the both what their skill set, their military MOS or designator, whatever it is, or what they do as civilians. We have professors, we have police officers, and teachers. And the first two have been tremendously helpful, particularly as we try to help out State Department with law enforcement efforts, or we help out with various training efforts, also mostly under State Department. You will not find us, quote unquote, maneuvering around the battlefield. We are a staff that is all about helping other people do their jobs. And we do very little ourselves. In a point of fact, when we go downrange to some of these countries to assist in training, and it's usually the same staff officer that coordinated and planned the event may well be actually executing the event.
It's funny, you kind of grabbed one of my questions I was going to ask later on, but I'll go ahead and pull the thread on, because I do find it fascinating how we man a lot of our operations. I remember my last deployment to Kabul, I was surprised how many reservists, National Guard, and even recalled people that you had doing staff duty there. And we used to kind of joke that it was the, when you look at everybody's background, it was in many respects a, you know, the island of misfit toys, in that you got some great skill sets, but many times that you just, people showed up what they had and you figured out what use they had there. Question I had for you is, those reservists that you have there on staff, do you have an opportunity to put in a request for people that have certain backgrounds? Or is it a situation where, as people show up, you evaluate their background and you try to find the best fit for them, or how to perhaps leverage something you didn't know had coming your way that you do have coming your way? And how long are those reservists deployed in theater with you before they go back home?
So the I'm getting worried now that you have bugged my office, because I'm always joking with people that we're running the island for misfit toys out here. But
you know what I mean.
You know, it really is a joke, because I have just been in awe of what these guys do. And starting with kind of the easy, I guess, metric question first. So the Navy guys are out here, generally speaking, roughly just shy of 12 months, and that has to do with their mobilization time eats into their year, if you will. The Marines, 6 to 9 months, and again, they're mostly active duty. The Air Force, 4 to 6 months, and the Army, most of the Army guys we are seeing, the staffers for 6 months. There's some flavors of Army that we see for, I'm sorry, most of the Army staffers are for a year, and then some flavors, for whatever reason, and I'm not quite sure the mechanics of this, are like 6 to 9 months. We have the ability to do a few requests for generally specific people. We can ask for skill sets, but we find that it takes so long, and in that, you know, I'm only here for a year, maybe a year and a little change, and it's you're building your the guy coming behind you's team, so you know that makes it challenging as well. We are so I've been here about just shy of 7 months, and we are just beginning. The general and I are just starting to see people we asked for back when we got here in January. A couple of people, less than five, if you will. One of the interesting challenges that we've run into is in the active force, you're basically assigned a job. You show up. If you get the job, you get the job. If not, you know, you kind of shut up and row. And whereas the reservists pick a specific job, and if they don't get that job, they're kind of their own career manager, if you will, and they feel like they've been compromised, or you know, sold a bill of goods, bait and switch, all kinds of things. And we find that you know, it's just a simple leadership thing. You have to sit down with people and explain, yes, you thought you were coming into this job, but really we need you to go over here. For the most part, people seem reasonably happy where they end up. In a few cases, they haven't been, and then you know we just have to spend more time with them and convince them, you know, it's time to be part of the team kind of thing. Not in a nasty kind of way. We try never to tell people just to shut up and row, but we try to let people understand this is where you fit in the big machine, and this is why we've you know, we put you where you are. But that has been a problem in the past, and we're trying our hardest to rectify it.
Every now and then, when we see stories about what CJTF Hoya is doing, we see stories on Army well drillers and all kinds of units like that. Are you still in that business? And what types of missions does your crew carry out?
So so the big joke about Hoa, I guess, well before I got here, was just what you said, kind of drilling wells. And we have stopped, for the most part, doing that. Now, whether we do that again in the future remains to be seen. But there was a lot of challenges in this humanitarian civic assistance, and I won't bore you with the difference. But in the civil affairs realm and, you know, building things for the various countries in the region, we weren't doing it right. We weren't fully integrated with either the U.S. Embassy country team, nor were we properly probably working with the host nation. We had a very competent Marine 03, like literally go through this whole issue from soup to nuts, and she came up with a set of principles about how we should approach this effort. And one of the, you know, a couple of the really important principles were that we wouldn't do anything if the host nation didn't ask for it and they weren't supportive of it. And we wouldn't do anything that when we were finished and we handed over whatever the project was, that it wasn't the local, it wasn't the host nation we were expected to, or expecting to take care of it. It was actually the community the project was in had to be able to take care of it, because too many times we built something and as soon as we left it broke, and the local community had no capacity to fix it, and the host nation, you know, maybe it was too far away from the capital or whatever, they weren't going to fix it. So we've totally revamped our approach. We've revamped it in theory for the most part now. We have a couple of what I would call like test projects, which are really ones that are left over from all the things we were doing before. And we're seeing how it goes, and then we'll figure out how much we want to scale up, or if we want to scale up at all. I'm not throwing stones at anyone at, who preceded me. I think they did what they did with the best information and given the situation they had. But we have fewer civil affairs assets now here than we did before, and we are having to look hard at what we're doing with them. And but your mention of well drilling is exactly right. There were a lot of issues in this realm in the not too distant past.
Kind of building off the well drilling, the civil affairs, a lot of what you know, your great photo ops. We've had similar experiences of that in other locations. I know, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan all have stories where you do these great projects, and just like you said, you drive down the street, you come back, 3 months later, and there's goats hanging out in the classrooms. But if you look at, you can go clockwise around the Horn of Africa from the Sudanese-Eritrean border and go down to Kenya-Tanzanian border. And a lot of these concerns we talked about before, they're all ashore, but they have a huge, whether you're talking about the sea lines of communications, the fisheries, potential natural resources offshore in the Western Indian Ocean, huge maritime importance there. But just like an Air Force, a Navy, whether it's what we call a Navy or a Coast Guard or even, you know, Harbor Patrol, they're very technical. They require a large degree of both real and human capital investments, not just to create them, but to sustain them over a long period of time. And that hasn't traditionally been one of the strong suits for the country in that area. And I've seen over the course of a few years a couple of a dogs and cat PAO releases that have made it through the filters that have come out. But what type of capability building and partnerships have we been able on the nautical side to help some of these nations get a little better control over what are some tremendously, not only economically important indirectly, but really for their people who live along the shores, especially in the fisheries area, are very important for their economies?
But you bring up one of the real, I guess, to be honest, weak points right now in our, I think strategy is too grandiose, but in the situation here. And, you know, one problem we have as CJTF HOA is our AOR, our remit, ends at the high water mark. And even if we wanted to do more, it's not our AOR. And in point of fact, it really, you start to get into the Central Command AOR and, Fifth Fleet business. So where we've been going with what you're talking about is the European Union and some of our allies and partners who are working in the region have been doing some things in this area. And, you know, going back to the gym team, the M, especially the multinational, we have been very slowly involved in conversations, particularly with the European Union, about their efforts. And we're trying to see how we can complement or enable them. And most of the enablement would be in terms of just sharing information, getting a common operational picture about how what we're doing on land affects what they would be building in terms of very limited maritime capacity, and vice versa. You know, one of the big, I won't call it an intellectual or military intellectual discussions, but a pretty active discussion going on is the whole idea, the difference between a Navy and a Coast Guard. And, you know, I think the general feeling right now, at least, is most of these countries need a Coast Guard. And we are working to try to figure out how to do that. One area that it has some promise is the a couple of the security cooperation offices in the region for the U.S. embassies. They are working on the Coast Guard problem, if you will, and we are working with them. I mean, some of this involves, unfortunately, a pretty not a steep educational ramp up, but you know, we have to get our people as they come in up to speed on all the regulations about security cooperation, because it's kind of an effort that's shared between State Department and DOD, and it's really about the attaches and the security cooperation officers in the embassy. I don't want to get all technical, but it's something, and we're just now dipping into it, but we certainly recognize it. And on the other hand, the other part of it is, given the dramatic fall in piracy in the region, especially off the coast of Somalia, we certainly want to take advantage of what's been accomplished in that area and not let, you know, in any way, shape, or form that problem crop up again.
Well, that Ray, there's some interesting issues. If you've got a country like Somalia, and I use the word loosely, but you've got all these semi-autonomous regions that maybe want to declare themselves to be countries like Puntland and Somaliland. Are you guys wrestling with those issues all the time too? Is that part of the charter you have, is to keep an eye on things like that and try and work with those folks?
No, I mean the policy of the U.S. is to one Somalia, basically, a federalist. It may be a federal state with Somaliland and Puntland being part of that federal state of Somalia or national state. And but it's right now it's kind of a bridge too far. And in that there are, like I said, partners and allies in the region working with them. We are trying to understand the challenges through their eyes, but we're not, not by way of excuse, but certainly by way of explanation. Getting here, just taking Somalia as an example, if you threw Somalia on the map of the United States, I think it runs from, the actual tip of the horn is somewhere up near the bottom of the southern border of Minnesota, and the bottom extends all the way down to either near or actually into Texas. And the sheer size of just Somalia, not counting the rest of our AOR, which is equally enormous, we have to be very deliberate in our choices of what we're going to do. And if an ally or partner is doing it, and that's in what you just mentioned, the Somaliland and Puntland, they are indeed, we tend to kind of not sink into the woodwork, but we definitely take an even more distant enabling role.
You operate out of the French or former French base, don't know how they draw on the lines nowadays, over there in Djibouti, Camp Limonier, which is kind of the eastern tip of the French area of influence in their former colonies in sub-Saharan Africa. And we've seen in the last couple of years especially, the French have expanded their presence, in Mali, Chad, and others. Question I have for you here is, how much do you coordinate with the French And the mission that France has expanded recently, I know it's a little more kinetic than what you do there, but it's they do more than just that. How much overlap is there between the missions that they're doing more in sub-Saharan Africa, what you're trying to accomplish there in JTF HOA, and what are the big differences in the goals that you're trying to achieve?
I would start by saying our relationship with the French, just, we're on one side, I think we're on the south side of the runway and they're on the north side, is absolutely phenomenal at all levels, not just the commander level, but, well on down into the various directors, like our intel officer meets with their intel officer, and they actually have, productive conversations. When I got here in January, I went over to shake hands with the French commander, and he was my classmate from National War College, and he was actually a friend of mine, too. He wasn't just some guy who was in the class. So we had an absolutely extraordinary relationship already started before I even got here, and it's unfortunate that he left about a month ago. But the relationship is phenomenal. The second thing is that our the French role here is different than ours. The French I'm not aware of the exact details. They have they are responsible for like the air security of Djibouti. And every day at 8 a.m., as anyone who's been here can tell you, the Mirages take off and go on an air patrol or do training. The French also use this. It's a huge training and test area for the French military. I think we've seen at least two, maybe three new French airframes come through here for their desert testing. It's a staging base for the French. I know that some of the French forces here have gone and supported operations in the Central African Republic. And I think Mali, but I'm not 100% sure about Mali. My suspicion is that our presence here allows the French to probably take the numbers here a little lower. But the French have, it's a much more complex relationship the French have with the our Djiboutian hosts than we have, because it goes back so much further, and they speak, they both can speak French. A lot of the Djiboutian officers went to the various academies in France, and certainly many members of Djiboutian society go to France. They'll be going in August here for vacation. So it's there's a cultural dimension to the French relationship that we just don't have, and I don't know if we'll ever have it. But this is one of, I can't remember, there are three or four main French bases in Africa, and this is the one for the northeast quadrant of Africa, and most of the forces deploy out of here. So, but the French have actual forces that they deploy from here, as opposed to what we're kind of doing with the enabling. But I cannot imagine doing our job here without the support and partnership of the French, and I cannot remember a better relationship with them.
I guess I'm still trying to grasp the mission you're working on. I mean, some percentage of the time of your people is being devoted to humanitarian affairs, civil administration issues, and the rest of it is cooperating with the local militaries to help them build themselves up. Am I on track with that, or have I missed the base?
Basically, our mission statement, which unclassified, it envisions three things. The first is that we will enable forces to execute operations to counter violent extremists in the Horn of Africa. So we don't do it ourselves, but we support any efforts that are made to do such operations. The second part of our effort is to ensure that we have access we maintain access to this base and into the various countries in the region. And a lot of that's about relationship building, but a lot of it is has to do with maintaining the base and the relationships with the Djiboutians in the particular, with working with the various country teams, U.S. country teams in the region, to maintain access, strategic access. And then the third thing is we are prepared to respond in crisis. If one of the embassies in the region needs security reinforcement, we have the Army's regionally aligned force. We have units from that force forward deployed, and we can send them to the embassy to help bulk up security at the embassy. Another thing, just kind of, this goes with the access and enablement, kind of crosses the lines. We sit on a seam, and we serve four different four stars. We serve the central, we support Central Command operations, we support AFRICOM operations, we support SOCOM operations, and we also pretty heavily support U.S. Transportation Command. We this airfield and this port sees a lot of activity as we move stuff into Africa for everything from supporting peacekeepers in Central African Republic to all kinds of other things in the region. And like AID has big warehouses here for food support. So it's a strategic logistics hub. And but the as far as the enabling our partners, what we do is we have a very small cell, the military coordination cell down in Mogadishu, that it's 5 people. And what they do is they work with all the entities that they can get to, for the most part, the airport itself, Mogadishu International. And they find out what is the sand in the machinery, what is keeping like the logistics from flowing or comms from working, or what training do the forces would they like to have had before they deployed into as peacekeepers into Somalia. And then what we do is we help either solve the problem or we advocate on behalf of the our troop contributing partners to get the problem solved. We work extensively with State Department to augment training being done for the Burundians or the Ugandans or the Kenyans, such that their forces deploy better ready to confront the current situation in Somalia. We do a lot where we analyze logistics issues, and we help those responsible for logistically supporting the troop contributing countries in Somalia do their job better, or maybe they don't have the resources they need, and so we advocate for their resources. We try to gain better situational awareness so that we can help inform the policy debate back in D.C. about Somalia and the region. The best way I can put it is there is an old BASF commercial that was something like, we're not the white in the paint, but we make the paint whiter, or something like that. It's hard to discern what we're doing, but we definitely make a contribution that is subtle but essential.
You mentioned earlier on the show, and I want to come back to it, about briefing the Japanese and the Koreans. And when you look back to before 2001, you literally required an act of parliament to get the Japanese military to get west of Singapore, and the Chinese just simply weren't a player from a military perspective. But it's the economics are the big thing. Obviously, the Japanese sea line of communications, maybe perhaps a lot of the Japanese concern is at sea. They also have a lot of fisheries concerns like the Koreans do. The Chinese, however, in the last decade have really gone all in Africa to access resources. There are tens of thousands of Chinese citizens who have basically immigrated there, who are working there. Chinese purchases of everything from farming lands to mines, and it's thrown a lot of money and a lot of influence around. And you have the traditional players in there like the French and the British and now the Americans. How do the Djiboutians, the Ethiopians, the Kenyans that you work with, how do they view the goals and the motivations of the French and the Americans when they walk into the briefing room door versus the Chinese and the Japanese mostly? How do they see the difference of why these foreigners are here and why they want to work with us? And is there some opportunity there that or maybe some concerns that we should keep in mind?
It's funny. I have not you see the, you know, just the Chinese, for example, you see evidence of them everywhere. The regional media is always writing about them and writing fairly accurately, I suppose fairly accurately about them. But it's really, I think the same way certain American companies have actually, you know, been doing pretty heavy investments in this region, it seems to be a much more economic thing, and it's the whole. I don't know where to begin on the whole soft power thing because I'm not sure. I think they have a different viewpoint on it. You know, one of the things that I have to constantly remind myself of here is that a lot of stuff I thought sitting back in D.C., you know, when I got here, it doesn't hold up. And you know, an example is we had a I told you every Saturday we bring in, you know, everyone that we can into brief, and we all brief and exchange what operations we have going on in the region. And I was struck by the Koreans, I think it was 2 weeks ago, gave a presentation on why they were in South Sudan. And they drew a straight line from their experience at being devastated from the war from 1950 to 1953 to the South Sudan being devastated by, you know, their war, and that they wanted to help, you know, they felt like they were paying back. And so the motives for a lot of these countries are why they're in the region are very complex, you know, extending everything from the traditional ties of the former colonial powers to, you know, these things that the like the Koreans. And the Chinese, you know, I think it's, I don't know, it's just they, I just don't, I haven't really, I've only talked to one Chinese government representative in the whole time I've been here, and that's the attaché here in Djibouti. And, you know, we don't talk about that. You know, it's enough that in my bad French and his, you know, his English, that we can even communicate at all. I don't feel remotely competent to answer the question, and mostly because I don't think it has an easy answer.
Eagle One?
Yeah, sorry, somebody lost sync there, probably me. When you're talking about the counterterrorism aspects of your job, I mean, we've got Al-Shabaab down there in Somalia and now drifted into Kenya, and there are a huge number of Somali refugees in Kenya. Are you all involved in that and working with NGOs and stuff? How far is your charter going in helping fight the terrorist efforts?
Our charter, if you will, is really about helping either the Kenyans or whoever is threatened by Al-Shabaab fight Al-Shabaab. And, you know, the other thing we try to do is help them with just orient themselves to the situation. And we try to be part of their staff courses to help improve staffing processes and, you know, so that they can do better planning to respond to the threat. With the General Grigsby, one of the things he's always pointing out is when Michael Jordan stepped on a basketball court, everyone played better because Michael Jordan was playing with them, and he was such a great example. And a lot of what we do is just going to these places and, you know, being, as the general says, being Michael Jordan. And it sounds, I'm sure sitting back there, it sounds kind of hokey, but it really, I can honestly say it's beginning to pay dividends. And especially when we talk to them and then they call us back and they say, well, this is the experience we had, or say we have an LNO from Burundi or the LNO from Uganda, you know, they'll actually show us pictures of what their forces are seeing, and then they will tell us, hey, this is what we need. We say, well, this is what we think we can get for you, and they'll explain to us why it won't work. And this exchange of information and this mutual learning and this making solutions that work for these militaries, vice, you know, just giving them a piece of, you know, as someone said, a licky and chewy, you know, a bag of goods, it seems it makes them a better fighting force. And ultimately, there are a lot more of them than there are of us. And they can, you know, Amazon has been pretty successful about against al-Shabaab, especially during their last offensive and certainly in the offensive before that.
You alluded to it recently, and this maybe personalize it a bit, but I think it's important to what you're doing there. Is like you said, you have almost three decades in special operations, and again, you know, every service's special forces have their own particular area of expertise and experience. But in the last decade or plus, a lot of people, when they think special operations, they think, you know, direct action, what gets the flash, what Hollywood likes to make movies out of it. But traditionally, the bread and butter is more of a long game operation, and that is building capacity and perhaps being a catalyst to indigenous forces to be able to give them the ability and support that they may not have organically to be able to do things that are in their national interest and just happen to be in ours as well. And I think most recently was the deployments that we've done to Uganda to help support them. But you know, as somebody who is from that background, I think your position is kind of old school to a certain extent, but for our special operations forces, how much of a refocus, just like the Marine Corps is having to go back and look back at their traditional missions and, you know, relearn and get better at them so they're able to carry them out because they had higher priorities elsewhere in the last decade. In the special operations community, you know, how much did y'all have to shift focus from that traditional mission? And is there, with the special operations forces, what we see in some of our general use forces, that getting back and remastering those primary mission areas that maybe had to be put on a back burner for a while?
No, if I was in person with you, I'd probably walk over and hug you right now because you bring up a lot of, like, phenomenal points. I think is... you have seen me kind of struggle a bit for the last 50 minutes to explain what it is we do over here. They're not making movies about, you know, I'll just kind of coyly call it indirect action. You know, no one makes movies about it. I think the last movie made about indirect action was probably like Lawrence of Arabia or something back in the 60s, or one of the Green Beret movies from the Vietnam era. But you are correct. I mean, these used to be bread and butter skills. You know, the Marines have the Manual for Small Wars from their time, you know, early in the first half of the last century. I know when I was an ensign at SEAL Team 1, we had the retiring CO or commanding officer of SEAL Team 3 come in and talk about his experiences in Vietnam with the PRU, the Provincial Reconnaissance Unit, I think that stood for. I mean, this is in our DNA. It's just been forgotten. And I don't worry about it too much because, one, I think not just SOF, but the, you know, U.S. forces in general are much more agile and flexible than we give them credit for. And I think we're learning rapidly how to do this. And I don't really have a choice either. So, you know, the resources to put a, you know, 10 brigades or whatever in Somalia aren't, or the political will aren't there. So, you know, we're going to have to figure out how to do it working through. And I think we will.
Eagle One?
Yeah, this is kind of an odd question for you, Emerald, but I was thinking about you being a Princeton grad, and I was wondering when you go to reunion and you're meeting up with all your investment banker classmates, what do they say when they find out you're a Navy SEAL?
So, interesting question, because the first thing is I haven't been to a reunion, first one in 1986. So I hope to get to my, I think it's my 30th next year, next June. And to be honest with you, in the 80s, they thought, when I ran into them, they thought I was utterly and completely insane. In the 90s, I think they thought I should be institutionalized. And then, you know, after 9/11, it became, you know, something fascinating to them. And you know what, I don't begrudge them that at all. I mean, that's, you know, we all went our ways. I went into the SEAL teams because I just couldn't face going to law school. And the longer I was in the Navy, the more I kind of, my reasons for serving got more, I don't know if I'd say honorable, but the notion of service definitely crept in. And then at some point in time, I looked at all these people who had worked for me and I had worked with, and, you know, I felt almost, well, I didn't feel almost, I felt I owed them, you know, my best effort. And, you know, I think they've kind of found their niche in the world and I've found mine. And I think we respect one another. And in a kind of funny way, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. When I see them, I want to talk about law and, you know, investment banking and that kind of thing. And, you know, naturally they want to hear what's going on in the SEAL team. So, it kind of all works out.
Oh, my wife is a recovering attorney. I think she would tell you you're not missing much. And to pull the thread, your stories are more interesting over a couple of drinks anyway, those you could tell. I kind of wanted to take the general concept we were talking about before and kind of extend it broadly, because you brought up something that I've heard other people mention before, and I've actually had this experience myself once, though I wish it happened more often. I wish other people had the experience. And you mentioned that, you know, the French commander on the base for a while was somebody that you had known before because you were classmates at the War College. And we have a very small group of officers, and a few enlisted too as well, who do these foreign exchange tours, that go serve in other countries, ride their ships, fly their airplanes, work on their staff. And, you know, these are JOs who develop relationships with the nation that they were serving with. And lo and behold, there are quite a few general officers and flag officers who will tell you a story about, there I was, I got off the plane, and there was Sven, who, you know, I played soccer with back when I did the exchange tour with the Norwegians or whatever. And there's a very undefinable quality to that you get more about not only looking how other people operate and can you, you know, take lessons back to our forces from what we learn operating with other nations' armed forces, but there is that personal relationship and that personal network that, is, especially with today's technology, are easier to maintain and perhaps spread out a little bit more. In your view, is that, and I'm not trying to make you the chief of naval personnel or anything, get you in trouble with Vice Admiral Moran, but is that a program that we really appropriately reward professionally for people who take that unobserved FITREP period of time? And is my assumption probably a valid one, that we get a lot of bang for the buck, perhaps not something that you can make a matrix out of, but in building that network internationally that really can play dividends down the road when people reach a senior level where they can really make things happen just because you know somebody on a personal basis and have served with them?
It's funny you bring that up, because I don't know what got me thinking about this a couple of days, but I don't know when it happened. I could not put my finger on it, but when I came in the SEAL teams, the PEP, the personal exchange program tours, were very much, they weren't frowned upon, but they weren't, you know, career makers, and a lot of guys got out after them. But somewhere, probably, I'm guessing somewhere in the 90s, that changed. And, another SEAL admiral that I know, you know, obviously know well because we're a small organization, he was the exchange with the German Kampfschwimmer Company up in Eckernförde. There's a captain, one of our real top-running captains, who was with the Italians. One of our brightest captains who's since retired, he also did a tour with the Italian Gruppo Incasori in La Spezia. And then we've had guys fighting to go to foreign war colleges, and not the ones, you know, not just the French or the British or whatever, the Australian, but also like the Indian and the Pakistani and places like that. And that, combined with the amount of combined operations that have taken place over the last 13 years, I think generation that are currently O3s and O4s in our military, it's one thing to be an exchange officer and play soccer. I mean, these guys fought and bled with a lot of our allies and partners. And I think, you know, when they are sitting where I'm sitting right now, you know, it's going to be a totally different idea of the international brotherhood or profession of arms. And, you know, I think there's like a magic number. You have to build up a constituency of people that support something in order to make it survive in the military, you know, in any military institution and in the culture. And I think the combination of the war and whatever happened in the 90s has made that begin to happen for language and, having worked extensively and deeply with foreign militaries.
If I were to ask you to name three things that your people are involved in right now that you would like the American people to know about, what would be the three top things on your list, Emil?
I think the first one, and above all others, is we are helping the Uganda, Kenya, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. I feel like I'm missing one. Anyway, we're helping them do what's necessary in Somalia and do it better and hopefully saving their lives and Somali lives as well over the long term. And I think I would hope that the American people recognize that there are a lot of ways to go after terrorists and other than drones and or remotely piloted aircraft and direct action. Yeah, it's like, again, we're not going to have a movie about it, but to kind of paraphrase Mr. Roberts, you know, they who do the indirect approach also serve, kind of thing. The second thing, and this is something that actually came up in an interview I did, I think it was Stars and Stripes a while ago, that I hadn't even thought of, but General Grigsby's really big on this thing called the Leadership Factory. And, his thing is here at CJTF HOA, here at Camp Lemonnier, we build leaders. And I hadn't thought anything of it, but I've never been in a place where every Saturday afternoon we have a professional development for our O6s. It's either an intel brief or it is some class that we give on a subject and to make them better officers. And then we also do a lot of outreach to the both the enlisted and junior officers. Both General Grigsby and I have open door policies. But I would like to think that if I kind of looked where CJTF HOA alumni are 15 years ago, they'll point back to this year or 6 months or whatever time they spent here, and they said, that's where I learned how to become a leader. And, once you leave, the various boot camps or officer candidate school or the academy or whatever, no one really talks about leadership much. You might get it at one of the Army intermediate level education things, but it's really, really stressed here, and we hit it hard, and we try to answer the hard questions people have. So the Leadership Factory would be a second one. And then the third one is I think there's this Chinese term, Guangxi, like Guanxi, and I think it's kind of like WASTA, but it's the quality of your connections, the quality of your network. And I think the network that, General Grigsby personally has built, but everyone else here who works with our partners in the region, what they've built in this region, this partnership, and now we're beginning to further the partnership between the countries in the region. So it's not just, them and us, a bilateral relationship, but like, say, the Ugandans and the Kenyans are talking more or that kind of thing. I think building this profession of arms in East Africa, when Somalia's done or the Amisom mission ends there, I would like to think that these regions or these the countries in the region, the militaries become, they're better, they're leaders, they occupy a stabilizing role in their countries, and they become less politicized. You know, that's the work of decades, but I think that would be the third one. But thank you for that opportunity to do that, and really for everything tonight, because like I said, it's a hard mission to explain to people. It sounds like I'm proselytizing for some cult, but we honestly believe in it here. We think we are, you know, building both better partners for the future and better leaders inside our own lifelines. And, you know, I'm more than happy to talk to you again for as long as you want to talk, exchange emails, whatever I can do to educate you and your listeners and readers on what we do here at CJTF HOA.
All right, well, Krongard, I really appreciate you. I know it's late over there, but not too late. Really appreciate you all taking time to call in from the far reaches of the Horn of Africa. It's been a great hour, a real informative and fast hour, and I know we all wish you and everybody else there at CJTF HOA keep doing the good work that you are there, and I really hope you have a great tour down the road.
Thank you very much. Again, I just appreciate what you guys are doing and giving us this opportunity to tell people about what we're up to.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you very much for taking the time, Admiral.
All right. Good afternoon. Good night for us.
Good night, and thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRat. And we look forward to seeing you next time. And until then, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.